are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Yawning this morning. Good morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, your snooze, smart talk all day. It is Thursday, the 11th of November, 2021, and you are on the clock with Erin Green. On the clock, we engage organizations, institutions, social and cultural leaders, and ordinary people to better understand the impact of public policy, private sector development, social and consumer trends. On the clock, we have conversations that help us understand and navigate a rapidly changing Bahamas. Good yawning this morning. I got an interesting conversation here today. At least I think it's interesting, and I hope you guys also find it interesting. After I touch on a few little news or slight housekeeping matters, I will be introducing my guests today, Cavante Cash and Ide Thompson. As we talk about events happening at UB this month, including an event this evening, the 16th annual Anatole Rogers Memorial. And the lecture this year is being given by Edwidge Danticat, Haitian-American novelist. And so I'm going to share details about that event later on in the show as we begin our discussion. First note, yesterday in the papers and on the news, I heard several figures admonishing Bahamians about their hesitancy to engage online banking options available to them. And I just thought that they knew already what the vibe was. I'm going to tell you right now, in case you didn't know what's going on, before you sort of try and shame Bahamians their sort of resistance to online banking. First of all, have you, the banking community, have you heard about marketing? Has anybody ever thought about marketing your online services to your clients? What about customer care services and technical assistance services? Do you guys have those available for people using your online banking services? Have you visited your own websites recently? Do they work? Are your apps and website designs optimal for handheld devices? Are you sure your customers can navigate your website on their electronic devices? Can customers understand the language used and instructions given on your apps and websites? And then, has anyone heard about the energy crisis? Have you determined how long it takes to navigate your website trying to access or complete one service or function? Are users able to spend the amount of money or data necessary to navigate your apps and websites? See, personally, after hearing countless horror stories about digital service after digital service, makes people like me, personally, it makes me hesitant to engage online banking. See, I don't even know if I have enough money to qualify for the headache it takes to manage my money through online banking. And this goes to all of the service providers coercing and forcing us onto digital platforms. First of all, you have to manage those digital platforms. You have to make sure that they work. You have to provide a degree of certainty to your client that across the board, consistently, this online service is going to be more effective and more efficient than the alternatives. Somehow you think that we must suffer through your growing pains as we pay to feed you. To all of those policymakers, whether in the state or in the banking industry, you have a whole lot of questions to answer before you could ask Bahamians why they're hesitant, not just to engage online banking, but to make it their main banking option. We're only touching on that briefly. There's another couple of things I want to touch on. First of all, dear government of the Bahamas, vis-a-vis the new COVID rules, you're not doing a very good job of explaining anything to us. We'd like a digital space that we can access to seek clarity on this process. Most importantly, you really need to tell us why you're rushing to end the state of emergency and at the same time telling us we have not reached a place where we can get rid of the provisions that come along with the state of emergency. So you could have a state of emergency without a curfew. You could have a state of emergency without a lockdown. You could have a state of emergency and describe the provisions however you want. Why are we ending the state of emergency but maintaining our citizens in a legal space where their rights continue to be restricted? And why are you rushing? You didn't have to rush. You could have continued to rule by state of emergency until you worked it out properly. But don't mind me. I feel like y'all feel like, since you have Mr. Wayne Monroe on your side now, that nobody's going to be suing the government. But I would take the time to get my ducks in a row before I move forward with this new dispensation of restricting people's rights. I think that is very, very important. Last note before we move into the show. In today's Tribune, in the business section, the article is titled, Change Law So Staff Pay for COVID Tests. The article is titled, Change Law So Staff Pay for COVID Tests. A top hotelier yesterday issued a, quote, clarion call, close quote, for the Bahamas to eliminate legal stipulations that mandate employers must pay for their workers' COVID-19 testing. So you acknowledge that the law as it exists right now requires you, or does not require staff to pay for their tests. And this article suggests your reading of it is that the employer is responsible. Well, since this is the tourism industry we're talking about, we think you could take a hit. We think for the purposes of this global emergency that you could take a hit. Since the law says that's what you ought to do, and we're all about following the law. And I too think it's a good look to have a Bahamian on the face of this lobby as opposed to the owners, the real owners of the tourism industry in the Bahamas, because that would be a bad look. That would be a very, very bad look. Okay, only got a little bit of time, so I'm going to read these texts and possibly get to these callers before we get into our show. Good morning. Central Bank called my friend's 101-year-old father lazy because he does not do online banking. You don't worry about that. Somebody from BTC called me stupid, saying that I didn't know that the fiber lines in my neighborhood were underground. I've been living in my neighborhood for 40-plus years, and I told them the only thing underground in my neighborhood is water and sewage pipes and my hopes and dreams. But they do, it happens. People think they could tell you anything in this town. Another text, Ms. Green, let Bahamians know to license their car now. No more free driving. That is another part of the discussion, the ending of the state of emergency. Another reason why I think the government has to do a better job of making it pellucidly clear to the Bahamian citizenry what is not just what is expected of them, what is required of them by law. Another text, great show as usual. Emergency orders over on Saturday. And now people have 30 days to license their vehicle. Road traffic will be a madhouse. Do you think that's enough time? I think they should give at least 120 days. Well, no, 120 days is 4 months. That is too much. However, what we could do, if we had a good grasp, you know, if we had a solid filing system, data system, then the same way that you come in and license your car on the month, right, that we need to organize it by month. Because road traffic knows who isn't licensed and who is licensed. And they have all of their data. They could call them, communicate with them, and set them a date. Systems could work, but I agree with you, 30 days is not enough time. Another text. They actually cannot end the state of emergency because Uncle Sam already getting upset over U.S. ending their state of emergency. U.S. put us on alert. Oh, they can't end the state of emergency because the U.S. is upset about us ending our state of emergency. They put us on alert 4. It means don't come here. So it means the PM will be forced to extend his emergency order. Do you think the U.S. government has that much control over our government? Another text. It says, yes, Aaron, show them up with the nonsense they are not ready for. How dare they expect us to pay for their lack of professionalism? Emergency orders rush is for the vehicle licensing money. Yeah, well, if that is the case, and I will say if that is the case, just a reminder to the government to stop prioritizing money and corporations over people's lives. Just in case you didn't know, a corporation is not a person or a human and should not have the same rights that humans do. Another quick text, good morning. We have 3 months after the emergency orders end. So we have 3 months to get the cars taken care of after the emergency orders end. That seems like a better amount of time. Another text. I'm going to read that text later in the show. Texter, thank you. Good morning, caller. You're on the clock. Good morning, caller. You still there? Did I lose you?
Hello. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Yeah, I'm on my cell phone. Morning, how you doing?
Good, good.
Yeah, we need to do a show on banking because it's not like you may be trying to make a transaction 3 o'clock in the morning too. It simply don't work.
Yeah.
We need to find out. I sure you heard of a clearing house, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How are we gonna move and digitize in our system for the future?
Yeah. Without a doubt.
Very for the future.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, you say you'll be having an election tonight, eh?
Yeah. I'm going to get into that in a bit. Tonight's lecture is the 16th annual Anatole Rogers Memorial Lecture.
And would I be able to watch it?
Yes, I'm going to give the details in a minute once we move into the second segment of the show.
Yeah, but like I said, I'll let you go. In the future, we needed to do a show on there. But this is back then.
Yeah. I want to do a series of shows with the central bank and the process of implementing the sand dollar and the digital accompanying digital wallet and all of the issues surrounding that. Because I don't have a problem with online banking. I have a problem with the idea that you're going to drag your consumers, your customers, your clients into services that are not functioning properly and then make fun of them and try and insult them as opposed to focusing on fixing your product.
My bank don't have an app.
There you go. Look here, I gotta go. Thank you so much. Good morning, caller. You're on the clock.
A godly day to the stock on the waist along with you, pretty eye, Aaron Grant.
Good morning, Brayman. How you doing?
I'm holding, thank God.
Good, good.
Tell that girl, before I make my point, right? Tell that lady, don't get into my space when I'm calling you pretty eyes, okay?
Yes, sir.
That's my space.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, a couple of things. One, the Minister of Health got to realize that we paying too much money for them not to have X-ray machine in the dental offices in the Princess Margaret and the clinic, and also hygienists and other machines in which the dental clinics need.
They need repair.
Fleming Street. So then he needs to stop joking and deal with the situation, because we're spending a lot of tax money to have those services. He are contributing to bad health in this Bahamas.
Thank you, Bremen. I got to go. I tell you, I enjoy that point, because I got to go find like $7,000 to go see the dentist when I could go to the government clinic if they actually fix the machines. Anyway, call you on the clock.
Come on, Darren. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
That's good. That's good.
Blessings.
Just wanted to chime in my two cents on this online banking thing.
Uh-huh.
I was listening to previous shows, and the reason why payment people should not rush into wanting to conduct business online is because of the major risk that the banks are not telling you.
Mm-hmm.
You could be at home, Aaron, and you'd be doing online banking. And the risk of that is that you could actually be, your identity could be stolen.
Right.
And the banks will not be held accountable for that. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Aaron, first, secondly, the person who issued that statement from Central Bank, total idiot. Okay? You should not be insulting your customers if they don't know how to conduct business online.
Mm-hmm.
All right? That right there is something that should have never been said for someone who was in a position who should be intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And I want people to understand that don't rush into that, because you're going to have many major cyber crimes happening, which is very possible, and we don't believe that. So take your time. Don't rush into it, and educate yourselves when it comes to that.
Absolutely. Okay? Thank you. You know, for me it is, how do we compel banks to provide the services that they are told and they acknowledge in their jurisdiction of origin are basic parts of the industry, right? Like, why is it that when they come here to our jurisdiction, they have no idea what we're talking about? These things that are a basic or standard part of the international banking, I want to say international banking, because it seems like some of the nationals are part of it, not all. Right, but the things that apply in their jurisdictions, that are basic in their jurisdictions, by law are required in their jurisdictions. People laugh at me in the bank when I start talking about these things, like even access to bathrooms. That's another point. Anyway, callers, I am so sorry. I got one call. You got 30 seconds. I got to go to my second segment. 30 seconds. You're on the clock.
I'll call you back another time, because this is going to take a while.
Okay.
So I'll call you back another time.
Thank you. Thank you, caller. We got to go to this break. Thank you, producer. And when we get back from this break, I'm bringing in my guests, Kevante Cash and Ide Thompson, graduates of UB, to talk about not just the Anatole Rogers Memorial Lecture, but the beautiful discussions taking place in UB over the month of November. Stay tuned to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. We will be right back.
What happened to you? You look like you lost your paycheck.
Man, I just realized I got scammed out of a bunch of money. They said I won this contest and just needed me to send them some money so I could collect. I mean, to expedite something. Or was it to smooth the process?
Man, you're smarter than that. Protect yourself against scams and fraud by following these tips. If you know you didn't enter a competition, you can't win. Never pay to receive a cash prize. If you're being asked, you're being scammed. Check trusted internet sites for verification of information given to you. Do not give your banking details to people you don't know. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. Monitor your bank account regularly for any questionable transactions. Get more information at GetMoneySmartBahamas.com.
Like what you're hearing on the show? Want to support the conversation? Sponsor On the Clock today. Call Janet Lees at 302-2304. That's 302-2304. Be the solution. Sponsor On the Clock with Aaron Green, where she dissects, we discuss, and you decide.
At Fidelity, the holidays are all about family, spending time with loved ones, and being thankful for the little things in life. Worrying about bills should be the last thing on your mind, especially during the holidays. Let Fidelity help you get your bills under control. Fidelity can also get you started with a real savings plan that actually pays you interest. The only thing you need to think about is what you will do with the savings in your pocket this Christmas. Now that's what I'm talking about. Fidelity Bank is here for you this holiday season because you are family, and family is important to us.
Good morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. You are on the clock with Erin Green. I got a text here that says, why should employers have to pay for employees' COVID tests? You need to change your mindset that all employers are villains. After suffering a year of losses, paying staff while no income. Businesses, the people who pay to add on your show, and I think they meant who pay to put ads on your show, have suffered too. Surely businesses have suffered. We're not talking about small little businesses. We're talking about huge multinational corporations that would have set aside money as a policy to take care of issues that may arise with their employees. You know, we ain't talking about the tuck shop. We ain't talking about the place where I just go buy cup. Then what we're talking about, multinational corporations. And in terms of tourism in the region, we're talking about institutions that traditionally pull out anywhere from conservative 50 to 90% of their profit out of the country, right? Certainly their casinos do. So while I can have sympathy for a corporation, always remember this: a corporation is not a person, no matter how the law treats them, no matter that the law has been convinced that they deserve human rights, like I, a human, deserve human rights. They are a corporation, and they have plenty, plenty money. And to be good corporate partners in a country, a small developing island state, to be good corporate citizens, that's what you do. Anyway, we're moving on to our next segment. We got to talk about this. Let me tell you why. Because the 16th annual Anatole Rogers Memorial Lecture given by Edwidge Dandekyat has got to be one of the most exciting things happening in this Christmas season, especially since we ain't having Junkanoo this year. And my two guests, Kevante Cash and Ide Thompson, are also two young and exciting voices in the Bahamian diaspora. They are both graduates of UB, and they are both now studying abroad in various master's programs. They are both writers, poets, and activists, like many of the voices featured in this discussion today. Good morning, Kevante, and good morning, Ide. How are you?
I'm good, Erin. And good morning, Bahamas.
Good morning.
Hey. Hi, I'm hoping you can hear me. I'm good, Erin. I'm good. Good morning, Ide, and good morning, Bahamas.
All right. Now, the first thing I want to say is don't have any fear. It is just as cold in the Bahamas as it is over there where y'all are. Tell the audience where you are and sort of what you're doing there. And why we had to put you out on loan, why we had to loan you all to other countries and institutions.
Okay. Well, right now in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. I'm studying in the MFA program at the University of Massachusetts, and I'm studying in a poetry program.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. I write poems. I can tell you all a poem I wrote the other day. Kevante, what you doing where you is?
I remember you saying to me a while back that you write poems and that you're actually really good, because I had an opportunity to hear you read before, but I am in Manchester, England. I actually am wrapping up my master's program in poetry. So very excited to be here.
Absolutely. I can tell you all my poem quickly. It's the best poem I ever wrote. It's entitled, "Why Do Big Grown Men Sit on the Radio All Day and Lotion Each Other When They Know Women Sell Lotion to Provide Goods for Their Children?" I didn't want to call the company name. They sell Avon, take care of the urine. That's the best poem I ever wrote. The best. And then look at life. Life is art and art is life. I on the radio lotion and other people now. It is beautiful. So
it's a cycle.
Tonight's lecture is entitled To Dream a Better World, Storytelling in Times of Distress. And it's given by Edwidge Danticat, Haitian-American novelist, short story writer, essayist, and memoirist. And the event is being hosted by the School of English and the College of Liberal and Fine Arts at UB. I'm going to give some details later. The second event occurring this month is the 9th Annual Critical Caribbean Symposium. And it's entitled Celebrating the Cultural and Intellectual Legacy of Sylvia Winter. And the keynote address is entitled Sylvia Winter's Caribbean. And the third event is an evening of poetry. Oh, sorry, that second event takes place on the 19th of November. And this third event, an evening of poetry, voices across the diaspora. This event is hosted by English Studies, the Blue Flamingo Literary Festival, and the College of Liberal and Fine Arts. And it features seven diasporic poets, including, and that means poets from across the African diaspora, Pat Ramming, Asha Lalawatu Ramming, our Bahamian Trinidadian sisterin, and poets from Nigeria, Canada, Barbados, England, Martinique, St. Lucia, and the U.S. It's going to be I think it's going to be some fantastic discussions. So I want to, just before we go, let me read briefly from Danticat's bio, and I'll read briefly from Sylvia Winter's bio, then I'm going to ask you all some questions. And so Edwidge Danticat was born January 19th, 1969. She is an Haitian-American novelist and short story writer. Her first novel, Breath, Eyes, Memory, was published in 1994. And so y'all could see how big it was. It went on to become an Oprah's book club selection. So it's big, big talk. Danticat has since written or edited several books and has been a recipient of many awards and honors. She was born in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince, when she was 12. Her father immigrated to New York to be followed 2 years later by her mother. And this left Danticat and her younger brother, also named Andre, to be raised by their aunt and uncle, extended family. When asked in an interview about her traditions as a child, she included storytelling, church, and constantly studying school material as a part of growing up. While in Haiti, she began writing at 9 years of age. At 12, she moved to Brooklyn to join her parents in a heavily Haitian-American neighborhood. Danticat did not realize the racism until she went to college because of the protection of her community. 2 years later, she published her first writing in English, A Haitian-American Christmas, Cremes and Creole Theater. In New York Connections, a citywide magazine written by teenagers published by Youth Communication. Now, she later wrote another story about her immigration experience called A New World Full of Strangers. And Danticat wrote, when I was done with the immigration piece, I felt that my story was unfinished. So I wrote a short story which later became a book, my first novel, Breath, Eyes, Memory. And she goes on to say, writing for New Youth Connections had given me a voice. My silence was destroyed completely and indefinitely. Now, I read that entire piece for two reasons. First, I wanted to show or to share how similar Edwidge's experience growing up was to many of us in the Bahamas, both Bahamian and of Haitian descent. And secondly, Danticat's telling of finding her voice. These three events that I mentioned coming from UB all center around the importance of voice through poetry, plays, and literature or critical work. Danticat's words in her own voice, a critical interrogation of the many voices of Sylvia Winter, and the many voices of and voices represented by poets from across the diaspora, can create a landscape where Bahamians, especially students, can begin to craft their own voices. Where Bahamians, in the face of what Many feel as political turmoil can begin to craft their own voices, can begin to contribute confidently to the collective national vision, to the collective political vision. Can simply focus on communicating their own voice and their own personal vision. And so conversations are so exciting, and not just for academics and pseudo-intellectuals like myself, but for everybody in the country. And so I pulled in these two young Bahamians studying abroad to talk with me a bit about these events, why they're important, but to start off with about their own work and their own voice. And so, Kevante and Ide, my first question is, how important is it for young minds and thinkers to engage and have access to these types of conversations like those that are being hosted by UB this month?
I guess I can take it first. I definitely think, it's incredibly important to be able to have the opportunity to have these conversations and to show like academia can kind of like stretch beyond just kind of like, you know, your basics, like science and medicine and math, etc. Right. Like academia can be creative and it can be poetic. It can be the arts, but also just that, like, moving beyond academia, like arts itself is supposed to be accessible to just like everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So while this like conversation is being like held in an academic setting, I think like it like being had within itself is like incredibly, incredibly important just to show like you can aspire to be an artist if you want to be. Like it is totally and like more than possible.
And I don't know, tell the audience, for me, I found that the conversations were very accessible when I attended events at UB of this nature. And I know people can say, man, Erin, but you're sort of a high-level thinker. They would be accessible to you. But as a student in the college, did you find these types of discussions accessible, like easy to listen to and easy to understand?
Yeah, like extremely. I was just thinking about like the first time that I attended like an Anatole Rogers like lecture with Sonia Sanchez, and oh my God, she moved me.
That was fire.
Like, I think that was a while ago.
Yeah.
I was like a solid like 6 or 7 years ago, but she just moved me. And at the time, I was doing my undergrad in journalism, and yeah, like I didn't really think it was possible for me to kind of like be a creative writer,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. And yeah, she just kind of like that really I had no words for her lecture. And then another incident that I'm thinking about is the Trinidadian writer that came to speak, I think about like 3 or 4 years ago. I can't remember his last name, but his first name is Kevin.
Mm-hmm. I remember the event, but I didn't attend.
Kevin Brown.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. So he actually, outside of the lecture, I went to another event that he hosted, which was a writer's workshop. And the way that he like orchestrated it, it was incredibly accessible. It was actually the first time that I read anything that I've before anyone. And he was like, oh, you're a poet. And I'm like, a poet? Like I didn't even think of myself as a poet like mm-hmm. at the time. But like his encouragement and just him saying like, no, this is poetry. And like encouraging me to like just keep writing. I found it to be like incredibly accessible.
Ide?
Yeah. And I mean, I totally agree with Kevante's statements, you know, because it's like having a voice is so vital. And it's like the school does such a good job through its lecture series, through the Lit Fest, through all of its programming,
mm-hmm.
to really give students, you know, and the outside community a platform where they can understand, hey, you can speak for yourself, you know, and in the Bahamas, being an oral culture, you know, where we talk a lot, where our stories are spoken, where communities are built through interaction, you know, it's like getting people to understand that you can be a creative, you can be a writer, you can be a spoken word artist and tell stories that impact not only yourself personally, but also your community is vital. And coming to these spaces where, you know, academics congregate together, and having access to that sharpens you, you know, mm-hmm. it sharpens your craft, it sharpens how you think, it sharpens who you see you can talk about and how you can talk about it. Yeah,
absolutely. I remember one of my favorite lectures was the Carolyn Cooper lecture, who's the Jamaican author, essayist, and literary scholar. And she came and gave a rootsy yardman lecture. It's like fire. And I know people sort of sitting on the outside of the building, they couldn't hear what was going on inside, would have thought we were in there having a stuffy, formal, remember to pronunciate everything properly lecture. But it was a down-to-earth, sort of common language discussion.
Exactly, yeah. And the thing is, you can do that in spaces like that, especially when you think about, you know, how we use Bohemian Creole English or Bohemianese, or what you want. We bring that into these academic spaces, and we use that to tell stories. People will gravitate towards it. They will pick that up. They will take that home with them. They will tell their children. They will tell their own families. And that invigorates how they see themselves, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's good idea.
So the second event on the 19th is the Sylvia Winter lecture, right? And she's not giving the lecture, but it's about her work. And Sylvia Winter is a Caribbean Renaissance woman. Like when I went through her bio and reading up on her and her work, I mean, she's just phenomenal. She's born in 1928 in Cuba to Jamaican parents. She's a Jamaican novelist, dramatist, critic, philosopher, essayist, and is best known for her diverse writings that pull together insights from theories in history, literature, science, and Black studies to explore race, the legacy of colonialism, and representations of humanness, right? Sylvia Winter's scholarly work is highly poetic, expository, and complex. Her work attempts to elucidate the development and maintenance of colonial modernity, that's like maintaining things of the past, and the modern man. She interweaves science, philosophy, literary theory, and critical race theory to explain how the European man came to be considered the epitome of humanity, or the figure of man. And I got a brief bio of her work, and then I have three pages of novels, critical texts, plays, and essays and criticisms by her. Three pages, right? But in 1958, she completed a full-length stage play that was bought by the Royal Court of Theatre in London. She published her only novel in 1962, Hills of Hebron. In the 60s, she returned to academia. In 63, she was appointed assistant lecturer in Hispanic literature at UWE Mona campus. In 74, the Jamaican government commissioned her to write a play about the Morant Bay Rebellion and a biography about Sir Alexander Bustamante, the first prime minister of independent Jamaica. Then in the 60s, she started writing critical essays. In 74, she was invited to be a professor in California. In 1977, she became the chair of African and Afro-American Studies and professor of Spanish at Stanford University. She's now professor emerita at Stanford University. In 2010, she was awarded the Order of Jamaica in the fields of education, history, and culture. I mean, this woman is just phenomenal, right? But reading her biography and reading Edwidge Dandekat's biography, and even if we look at Pat Ramming and Asha Lalawatu Ramming, I think no relation, but both of them are both, I think, engineers and or architects and phenomenal poets. And so I have to ask this question. Which came first? Is it the activist advocate or the writer poet? Right? Is it the writer poet, or is it the engineer, the builder, the creator of things? Are these things inextricable? When did you become an activist, and when did you become a poet? Because in the lives of these people, they can't seem to keep these things separate.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's kind of hard to kind of like separate like your art from just like your entire identity, like your existence. I've been kind of leaning into this like thought that like just my existence is resistance within itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess like by default, just like me living my life, just doing the things that like, so as long as I'm not harming anybody, keeping me content and happy and just like ensuring like I'm not neutral in like situations of like obvious injustice, I think like, I mean, and it's still weird for me to be like, oh yeah, 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 I'm an activist, or like I advocate for like marginalized communities. But I think like the advocacy had to come first for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think for me, how I realized that I was a poet was through connections, through Bahamian poets like Sonia Farmer and Yasmin Glinton and like Tanisia Pratt, Ede Thompson, like all of these connections, like, and then being a part of like workshop groups and realizing like, oh, okay, I think I could write. And then them encouraging me, actually, no, you could write and you could be better.
Uh-huh.
And like, write your story, like write your story. Cause that would in itself, like writing your story is you advocating for yourself, mm-hmm. advocating for your family and advocating for people whose stories are kind of like similar, like, oh, I'm writing for everybody who has like similar stories to mine, but just like representation. And that's kind of like how I realized like the two just kind of like interweave. And it was just like, it just made sense to me to kind of like flow in the direction of producing work that represents like the communities that I belong to, but also is true to my identity, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Ide?
Yeah, and like, it's like, I also agree, like, they really can't be separated. And then it's like, everyone has their own kind of path to this process of becoming this kind of hybrid or moving between these categories, you know, because even sometimes I think when we don't think of ourselves as being an activist or being a writer or being an artist in some form, we're doing this work. You know, it's all about like how can I just say, like when she wrote, she was advocating for herself first. And then it expanded outward from there. You know, so I think there's this idea of success. It's just how do you call or name yourself? Mm-hmm. And then what skill sets are you developing when you move that process and how you use them.
Now let me ask you a question. Yeah. Is naming yourself, giving yourself a nickname or a new name, is that a mm-hmm. vital part of finding one's voice? And do you mm-hmm. see a lot of that at UB? When I was at COB, everybody had a nickname mm-hmm. and that was important. Mm-hmm. That part of your identity mm-hmm. was important in that college space. And while you were at UB, is that sort of culture still going on? And do young people still sort of, is that still an important part of finding our voice?
Mm. That's a good question. I think that, I know that's what you call a culture, like a thing people do specifically, but for me personally, like my friends call me nicknames based upon what I would do in class, and we would call each other part of our sense of friendship with each other, but also what we saw the skill sets coming out of each other, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that by renaming yourself, by calling yourself something else and giving yourself that power, you are beginning to think about and I guess rethink who you are as a person and where you can go in life. And I think that's what college as when this foundational thing should be about, especially in the country like the Bahamas, where, you know, we go through so much social turmoil, we go through so much political turmoil, and we constantly have to think about how am I going to get through this? How am I going to build myself up to make it through these challenges? And I think you're going to do that really by taking control of who you are and how you see yourself and so forth.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Absolutely. Mm.
Sorry.
No, go on.
No, I was just going to say, some valid points, Ide. But, like, in responding mm-hmm. to your question, Aaron, I think, like, for me, like, funnily enough, I just was thinking about this. Like, from when I was in high school, people was calling me like Maya Angelou because literature was like my favorite subject in high school. And they used to kind of like make fun of me because I really used to be so attentive in literature. And I was so proud of getting like that A in my BGCSE. And then when I went to UB and studying like journalism and connecting with like just like the journalists that you see on in the papers, et cetera, like these are people that I like studied with, and like them just kind of saying like I always had like that creative streak. So I don't like I kind of like never really kind of followed like I guess like hard cutting journalism, but for me it was always like arts and music and entertainment sort of journalism, and that's kind of like how I like went into the direction because people just kind of saw that within me, like they saw like just that creativity and kind of like pushed it, and like friends would kind of call me like Baby Badu, et cetera. Yeah. And I guess like from there, I just kind of started thinking about my own identity and what does it mean to like put onto me and do I want to accept it as my own? And then like, once I sat with it and it resonated, it was like, oh, okay, well, I guess this kind of sort of is my thing in a sense, like my, not entire identity, but parts of my identity. And like, how do I want to express this in a way? Since people are already watching, people are already paying attention. So how do I want to express it in a way that's like, just valuable to the world, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Before we go, and well, I'm going to ask you one more question, and I got to read the details for the three events, particularly the one tonight. I want to ask you, in sort of taking us back to the title of this evening's lecture, which is To Dream a Better World, Storytelling in Times of Distress, I want to say to you, two young poets, or you know, to ask you to share a word of with the listening audience, and in particular to young people, the power of storytelling, of telling their own stories, of telling their stories through other people's voices, right? So, like, maybe you're shy and you don't want to give a, you don't want to write a biography, but you want to sort of tell your story through other people's lives or through other characters. Let's just talk briefly about the importance of storytelling in times of distress.
Yeah. So I got this quote from one of my really good friends this morning, and it's from this writer, Jacqueline Woodson, and it reads, "I do think that in writing, literature can be that tool for young people to see themselves again, to see the world and imagine it differently." And, you know, I think that's the key when you think about how working creatively allows you to rethink and reimagine, you know, your space and who you are. It really does allows for this amazing thing when you put your traumas, your triumphs, whatever you're going through in another character or another voice, and you can work through that on the page, you know. Not only is that cathartic, but it gives other people the right, or at least the ability, to move through their own mental and emotional processes. And so in that way, you know, being creative is inherently an act of love, you know, for yourself or for others.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much, Ide, and thank you so much, Kavante Cash. My guests today are Kavante Cash and Ide Thompson, two young Bahamians abroad engaged in their master's programs in literature and poetry, or in poetry as a single subject. Question?
I'm studying poetry, and I think Ide said that he's also studying poetry as well.
Yeah, they're poetry as well.
Yeah. Awesome. I wonder if the political culture considers the importance of a national poet, right?
A
poet laureate, a person who has been appointed to capture the individual voices of the country and the collective national voice.
Yeah, I mean that to me is such a beautiful thing, but also very challenging. I mean, to the power structures.
Yeah.
Like, I'm thinking about, you know, like Adrienne Rich and her when she was to get this award from the U.S. for her writing.
Yes.
And how she eschewed that because she said, or shouldn't be, you know, be has to political motives in certain ways. Like it should speak the truth, you know, be a mirror to the powers that be and society. So that'd be a very interesting to see how that would come out in the behavior space, you know.
Yeah, but I think it's something that we should aim for.
Yeah, definitely, definitely, you know, because we need that outlet, right. You know.
And for me, you know, as a politician, look, how can politicians spin and twist the truth if we have mm-hmm. someone whose job it is to document mm-hmm. and to capture and express mm-hmm. the collective national voice, you know? And then we weigh that against mm-hmm. the national political vision. Anyway, guys, I want to thank mm-hmm. you so much. I am all out of time, and I got to give just a moment to my texters. So let me give the details for the event this evening. The 16th mm-hmm. annual Anatole Rogers Memorial Lecture is being given by Edwidge Dandekat, and it is entitled To Dream a Better World, Storytelling in Times of Distress. It is tonight, Thursday the 11th of November at 7 p.m. The meeting ID is 976-4346-9494. The meeting ID is 976-4346-9494. And if you want further details, you can go on the UB School of English page for a flyer with further details to connection. The other events are taking place on November the 19th and on November, I think, the 27th or the 26th, and we will talk about them in upcoming days. To my listening audience, I want to thank you for all of your texts. There's some very interesting texts about the banking situation. We're going to talk about that more in the upcoming weeks. Thank you for joining in. And I hope that you guys tune in to the 16th annual Anatole Rogers Memorial Lecture tonight. Look for the UB School of English's Facebook page for further details and to register for the event. It's 11 a.m. I got to go. Tomorrow, joining me in studio is Brentford Hall, a.k.a. Simeon Hall Jr., the man who almost can make me eat meat for Thanksgiving. We're talking about his new international feature in Bon Appetit and how to eat Thanksgiving the Bahamian way. Have a great day, Bahamians. And Unleash is up next.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.